not sure.
Is that a change? Welcome to the March 8th, 1 p.m. Board discussion session. It is 1 p.m. and we are in TDC. Meeting is being recorded. Welcome to the, those in the audience, welcome to our discussion meeting. There is nothing on the agenda, but I'll go down. First thing, Mr. McCain, do you have anything?
No.
Mr. Searcy?
No.
Ms. Menace?
Yes, I wanted to follow up. I was negligent in double checking during our discussion. Last time I talked about the possibility of having an evaluation for our lawyer. There are two people that we hire and evaluate in the school district. That is the superintendent, who we do have an evaluation for, and our attorney, who we don't have an evaluation for. In previous years, I had brought that up, and we got to the point where Ms. Stang actually researched and got us examples of evaluation forms that other school districts use. At the time, the board corporate chose not to do that, and I think this is an opportunity, now that you know we have a different board, we have different ideas, I just would like to revisit that and see if there's any interest on the part of the board of pursuing any type of evaluation. And I'd like to preface it with saying that it's not that there's anything in particular that I'm concerned about, but I do believe that that is part of the due diligence and the responsibility that we have. We evaluate the superintendent every year, and that does not have to be a negative thing. Right, and so I see this through that lens of affirming that which is working well and being aware of any areas where improvement might be. So that's the that's the context. It's not a witch hunt in any way, shape, or form. Mr. Fox.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's a good management practice in this meeting. I appreciate you bringing that up.
Anyone else?
I'm not in favor of it. I think we ought to bid the thing out, like I mentioned several different times, and just see where we are. No offense to the beautiful lady who's sitting there, but that's something that is a real stickler in the community, the amount of money we pay for the school board attorney. And I think we ought to just bid it out and see where we, how we can fare.
I agree with that sentiment as well. I think that what begins with Mrs. Mendez's process, I think we should look at it and evaluate it against. I guess if there exist criteria, then we should look at those and see where the current offering resides and where we can possibly look at other options.
Yeah, I just think it's important to remember that we actually have in the past, I can't remember if it was 2 or 3 years ago, we actually did do exactly that. And one of the goals the board had was to try to have local representation. And in doing that search, we found that while we have a lot of lawyers in our community, there aren't any. And at the time, there weren't any that had this education law background that we were looking for. However, we did put on the rotation for legal advice and legal cases, local lawyers that could do, you know, different types of work that they were qualified to do on behalf of the school district. So, you know, it's not that we have been negligent in trying to find local representation. It's just that it's very specific. You wouldn't hire a general practitioner to do heart surgery and just say, well, they're a general practitioner, so they should be able. You can't just hire any lawyer and say, oh, well, that lawyer should be versed in the intricacies of education, law, and statutes. That is just not in the best interest of the school district. So my intent is to look at an evaluation. My intent is not to begin a process of doing a search yet again, unless, of course, you know, that is what the board would like to do. I'm just talking about doing our due diligence and doing an evaluation.
I'm going to weigh in on, and they are two separate issues. Thank you. I think that, in fairness, an evaluation is a good process, especially if we're talking about the second issue, which is going out to bid. Because the, if, you know, sometimes it isn't price, it could be years of service experience. And in fairness to our existing attorney, who said I've been complaints, however, just if you're hiring somebody, they have, it's important that you let them know how they're doing. It's important that they have, if through the second process didn't win a bid, let's say, that they're, you know, if there was a good evaluation and they leave with a clean slate, or if there is some problems criticisms, anything that needs to be corrected, it's done at the appropriate time and with everybody weighing in. So just in the professional world, knows that this is, we do with our superintendents. I have no problem with having an evaluation. I would like to see those examples. I would like to see that brought forward. I would like to see what that looks like. And I have no problem supporting them. The second issue about going out for bid, my experience in purchasing, I'm very familiar with, you know, just a personal experience having, in another capacity, having a local vendor go out, you know, love them, they liked it, but again, it's public trust, it's public money. We went out to bid, and that local vendor beat themselves by $5,000 a month. So they remain the vendor, but they beat themselves because of competition. Competition breeds the sharpening of the pencil. So I don't find a problem in that. That is our job, is to, with the public trust of money. So I know that I've been on the board 2 years, and I would, just not sure of a year of contract. But it is, in the public sector, a responsibility to go out in fairness. We do that with our administration building. We do that with every facet of when we spend our dollar over a certain amount. And due to the amount, and due to the fairness, and due to breeding competition, I don't think it's a bad practice. And I am certainly, and have to say up front, that I'm totally satisfied with our current attorney. But I do think that those are both good practices, and I would support.
Okay, so moving forward, what is the direction?
Well, I would think that there is an issue there. So we have to, and this is where we have to ask the attorney, I believe our contract with her has renewable in March. The date is March, is that correct?
At this point, the legal services contract is month-to-month, 30 days to terminate.
So, then with that being said, we can't make any actions here. I don't know if we have consensus, because nobody's waiting. I mean, I shouldn't say, I haven't heard everybody.
I'll give you my two cents. I mean, just personally.
Sure.
I've got an admirable employee who I can get rid of at my leisure in my room. Not even in 30 days, but my office is today. I wouldn't bother with an evaluation if I was at the board meeting, just because of that relationship. In terms of putting out a bid, you know, now it's a new board, you guys want to go through that again, fine. And I was the one who led the trip to the last time, especially when Mr. Pegger got on the board. We had an attorney on the board. And, you know, we found out that there was not a whole lot of local people who had that kind of knowledge base. And the other thing you found out is, if you look at it from a price per hour billing, we weren't going to save a bit of money. In fact, we're a lot more higher. Some of the local ones were higher. Again, it's a new board. If we want to go through the dog and pony show again, I'll sit right here with a smile on my face and take part. But
sure. It's not a new board, but we have brought up there are two, although you both have to June, there are two possible new seats at the overall. I think that's probably something that I think I would not take action this time. I'll allow the new board, the real new board, because I don't feel our two existing board members who are only a year behind me are new anymore to weigh in. So I think for me personally, I'll weigh in and delay action on that. But I would support it. The new board is in favor of that.
And the only thing I said new board is that it's a different board. That was
no, but I'm saying we're going to have a new board possibly shortly,
absolutely.
So it's just going to be
absolutely.
An exercise in.
Well, but wouldn't delaying any kind of bid be prudent, but to working towards even supporting the new board and having an evaluation system in place would be helpful so that everything isn't, when they come in, you're going to slam up with all the stuff that you've been waiting for them to take charge of.
I totally support the evaluation process. That I do support on an annual basis. If you hire someone new, and plus collectively, I think that somebody should know what they're doing.
Good. So could we ask Ms. Stain to compile those evaluations again?
I would like to see what she brought forward to the previous board, which was herself, was it? If she still has that. Ms. Stain?
I'll take one through.
Yeah. So if you could send that to the, give us copies and then put it under my matters next discussion. Okay. Thank you.
I have a question. What is the criteria for the school board kind of hiring? You folks may not remember, but I know when I was on the board before, we had an outstanding school board attorney who was a force officer. There is no training, to my knowledge, to be a school board attorney. You don't get a law degree in school board attorneyism or whatever, to my knowledge, but maybe attorney.
I'm having a little hard time. I don't know if you said divorce attorney, but could you put, also because we're being recorded, could you put the mic a little closer to you? Thanks.
He was a divorce attorney.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So how do you rate something you don't even know what the criteria was for hiring him to start with?
You're still not talking to him.
Okay, I'll go ahead.
Just crossing.
Sure. I think Mrs. Amanda's point is well taken. In having conversations with other school board members around the state, many of them have relayed to me that they found themselves in trouble with the law because they don't have someone who has experience in the educational. So it is a very specific skill set. And obviously, Mrs. DeGrista has a far better handle on this, but my understanding is there's an organization for school district attorneys within the state, or there's professional development specific to that realm. So while a local candidate would be preferred, my main concern is making certain that, and again, no one is unhappy with the current services. Well, I don't know. I'm not unhappy with the current services. However, I do feel that looking at the market and seeing if there is a more cost-effective approach, and I think it's an exercise that should be conducted annually, every 2 years or so. So I would support Mr. Searson's motion and not wait for the new board. I mean, obviously we could delay the decision until the new board would gather information. At this point, seems
that wasn't a motion.
Correct. His thinking. No, I'm sorry. I've been on the Florida channel for the last 6 years. First, the assessment information, which whatever Ms. Stein currently has, and then secondly, we'll get going to market or the RFP process or something like that. Any other questions? Any information you'd like to have?
Would it be fair to ask for understanding that sort of bring back evaluation stuff. Would it be fair then to ask her to bring forward the last RFP for the attorney for us to review at the next special meeting, and then as we build upon this thought? And this way I can see what we're looking at?
Absolutely. It would be informative to the board members that we're not on the board what we actually know. So that's good. More than 2 years ago.
Yeah.
We've been on the board for 2 years. It was 3 to 4 years ago.
Sure. So I think that if Ms. Mann can bring forward the last announcement for a job announcement and bids, and then also any evaluation information, supply us with that prior to the next discussion so we can review and openly discuss again. I put in front of you, Ms. Fang had brought to my attention, although I don't remember the 2015 review. Apparently, we have an annual review.
Yes, it's an annual review for the resolution of protocol.
The resolution calls for protocols. Attached is the set of procedures that we have in place. Example one was regular business meetings are televised and replays, and those are our process. At a glance, or if there's anything that needs to be, it says that there'll be a yearly review.
I just have a clarification question. We have second to last information sessions with the superintendent. Are those being replaced with our monthly session? You know how we have the workshop, the discussion workshop for the board, and then at the end of the month we have our workshop with the superintendent. Is the intent to replace these with those?
I would say that would probably be better if we change that to superintendent discussion sessions, but those are recorded.
We have decided the last couple times, and probably the next few times, if not all the time, to do those in a workshop format, because there's more transparency in a workshop format, more access to information. So, but this catalog of options that you have still has information sessions as an option. So mm-hmm. Maybe we need to change.
So should we add?
We could, yeah, my recommendation would be to add that, but since you are a new superintendent with us, and I don't believe in the time that you've been with us, we've had an information session, it would be good for us to have an understanding of what that would mean for you to call me. Versus a superintendent discussion session. It could be on the menu, but what would it entail? Because when we did have these sessions, I think your comment was very apropos. There was a lot of important information that was brought forth at those sessions, and there was no recording, right? And so if we are moving towards an era of greater transparency, I think that would contradict what we say we're doing in trying to be more transparent. But if you had a different understanding of what the purpose of the information sessions were, because the only places where we don't have to have those open sessions are when we're doing executive sessions around litigation and legal stuff. Just for clarification.
Mrs. Susan, one of the ladies.
Who would be sitting in those six chairs? Then you've got to get no recording out of there.
Yes.
It's a violation of sunshine law. You're sitting in a meeting with all six of us talking about things that might not come up.
Yeah, I can see if that was for this.
It needs to be recorded. If we're going to be sitting together, it needs to be recorded in some fashion.
I think there were there minutes this day? Do you remember when we had information sessions? I recall this was always there.
Yes, there were minutes taken of those sessions.
So there was written.
Do minutes suffice?
Yes, sir.
The law requires reasonable notice, access by the public, and that minutes are taken. It is not a legal requirement to record or to televise or these, all these other things. That's a local decision that you can certainly make.
To make sure we don't get in too deep of water, I would suggest if we are all together in a meeting, maybe at least a video or audio.
Sure. And I would agree with that. But Dr. Rendell, in lieu of this, should we just scratch this and put your superintendent, this workshop, and put it as reported? Or do you want to keep that slot open just in case?
I can't think of a time right now. I can't think of a time that I would want to meet and not have to be recorded or televised. So I don't know if I see a need for having an information session that we just have minutes for. But
and you would certainly bring, I would imagine, up to your discussion. You use that venue as the time to bring forward information.
Yeah, but you give. Some of the workshop, that's typically what we're trying to do is get into this routine where second Tuesday of the month, our first meeting Tuesday of the month, is this discussion session. The second meeting, the fourth Tuesday of the month, is the workshop.
So I would say this every from year to year. I don't want to take anything away, but at the very least, we do have to add the superintendent workshop, and in the middle. For recording, we do televise those, correct, your workshops?
We record them, they're not televised.
Record them, okay. Record them and
videotape.
And so if we made that addition, is that the only addition that has a census that I see for review?
Oh, it would be negative. Again, and we'll see how it goes this year. I feel as though these workshops are not productive. There are very important stakeholders in the audience with whom we don't engage. I'm just wondering if there's any interest at all or some history behind why we don't have a more engaging process, whether it's citizen input at the end or things along those lines. Or is it possible for me to just say, Ms. Cannon, what is the union's position on this side or the other, and she can say it? Or it's somewhat bizarre to sit here in a museum on display, and I feel as though perhaps our workshops, maybe just the board one, maybe the second one, may have an opportunity for citizen input or more robust engagement. But like to know the other board members' thoughts on that.
What's your suggestion? What are you saying we need to do?
Well, a more engaging approach for our workshop, just like today, where citizens can weigh in somewhat rather than just grabbing each of us after the meeting and sharing their viewpoints. And it's just, to my mind, it's a little bit more open and transparent interaction with the public rather than working in silos. I mean, sunshine law is so prohibitive as it is. It's difficult for constituents to get a hold of us independently, especially when there's a matter where we could ask a question. And to me, it's just a better way of doing business on behalf of people. But that's just one of those.
Yeah, the board has had those conversations, and I think one of the examples I think Mr. McCain might remember was a particular workshop that we had that had to do with charter schools. And a lot of questions were brought up. All the charter school principals were in the audience, and there was no opportunity to engage them. And that was such a wasted opportunity, because what ended up happening was after the meeting, board members had questions, and they had to go and call each of the principals and grab them on the way out or make appointments later to follow up with them. And so that's an example of where if you have a process, because the fear, and I think, I don't know if it's the county commission or the city council, they're trying to move back towards kind of restraining some of that input, because you get people that come in and they will monopolize the microphone for hours, and that doesn't benefit the taxpayers, it doesn't benefit the board, because you can't really do the work of the board. We get criticized for our three-minute rule, and, you know, whether you like it, not indifferent, you know, personally as a board member, I welcome the input. I think that in 3 minutes you can make an argument, and everybody knows that if you have a longer argument to make, you line up five people and you use 15 minutes. I mean, that's not rocket science. But it's orderly, and nobody can get up and start grandstanding, because in the end, that doesn't benefit anybody. So I think that when we've had those conversations, they kind of stop there, because there was no discussion about how, okay, if we really want to have that kind of engagement, how can it be done in a meaningful way where you don't get grandstanding and wasting of people's time with particular agendas? And that's always, you know, it's like, how do you do that? Who's to call the shots? Who's to judge? What is, you know what I mean? And I think that's what stopped us from doing that. I agree with you. I think sometimes there are issues where I wish that we could hear from people that are sitting in the audience that have experience and have a comment. And what we have done, I don't know if Matt remembers any of those times, sometimes the board has asked the chair, you know, Ms. Cannon is here, she might be able to give us some information. I know I did that once with the SHAC committee. Somebody from SHAC was there, and nobody knew what the deal was with SHAC, and so, hey, the chair is right there. Can you let her tell us? And the board said, yes, the person can come up and, you know. So
a motion to suspend the rules.
Right. So it's a little complex, but I think it would be worth exploring and seeing if there's consensus to do something that will be valuable for the community and for the board.
Well, this is my experience, and I do agree, and I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. This is my experience in having started on council, and also sometimes it's, you know, where, you know, during election years, the House is packed, and there's just because it depends if that meeting is being televised, and the input is for different reasons. There's also where you could have one council member, board member, commissioner call in because they want to stack the room. Thank you. And then you have 3 minutes each person and 30, you know, and again, that's whether it's televised or not, or just so I'm not saying that that's always going to happen, but I really do feel that if even with the 3 minute here, 5 minute when I served in Sebastian, it was up to a board member to say, you know, the ding ding, your little buzzer goes off, and a board member would say, I would like to continue to hear Ms. Cannon, and I'm using you as an example, to continue her thought, her speech, you know, or her point, to continue to make her point. And I think that's what I'm saying is maybe because we are semi-new, a rigidity in that, and I would like to see more of that. If we do see that, if you do have a issue come up, I would welcome that you request from me, because we have Ms. Cannon come up and we ask her some questions, since it's about health care and what's going on, or something that doesn't violate any negotiations. But in that respect, I would welcome that input, but with limitations. So if we were mindful about that as a group and then see where we move from there,
I think
before we actually change a policy.
And actually, this would be perfect because it would be experimental, if you will. Again, when you have your new board come on, you have some experience of, well, we tried this, and these are the, you know, so we can find it. So that's a great compliment.
So we all know that just given a little hello, I'd like to hear more from Cannon, or that would be fine.
I want to try to represent. This is the way I understood this for 7 years. These information systems, these are our meetings.
Sure.
We ask the superintendent to sit in on. We ask the superintendent every now and then, he's got some, hey, he'll give the chair, hey, I got something I want to, you know, talk to you guys about. This is your classic. If board members want to have somebody from us, we can.
Yeah.
What we always did not want to do is just open it up and say,
sure,
3 minutes, and then you get all the, you know, just like it.
All the other stuff. I think with that being clear,
we'll try to make too big a deal.
Have a little more interface with our attendees when needed, when we have a reason to do so. At this time, I'd like Dr. Riddell, turn it over to Dr. Riddell for his time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you remember, we engaged in a contract with the District Management Council a short time ago. The District Management Council has been asked to come in and do a complete review of our Exceptional Student Education Department, our ENC department. It's actually a multi-year contract. They're going to come in and do a review, give us a report, and then help us develop a blueprint to make sure that not only are we providing the services that our students need, but making sure that we're most efficient in how we provide those services. As part of their report, they come and gather information. So they have sent a team here, three individuals that you have in front of you, Sam, Kristen, and Melissa, and they're going to talk to you a little bit about what the District Management Council does, what they're doing while they're here. They're here for 3 days. They're interviewing ESC teachers. They're interviewing principals and assistant principals. Groups of students and stakeholders are also randomly visiting classrooms, randomly pulling files and checking information to make sure that what we're doing is what we're supposed to be doing. So while they were here in town, I asked if they could stop in and give you guys just a brief kind of sketch of what they do and what they're doing while they're here. So Sam, we'll turn it over to you.
Great, thanks. And we're just getting a presentation set up.
Technical difficulty.
While we're doing that, I can stand
up. Okay,
I'll just... So I can begin just giving a little bit of background. First of all, thank you all for giving us the chance to talk with you here today. We'll share about 20 to 30 minutes talking about what we're doing as the project overall, and then also explaining a little bit of detail about what's coming up in the short term. And then we want to make sure that we have time for questions from all of you as well. Just to begin with introductions, my name is Sam Ribnick. I'm a director at the District Management Council. And also here is Kristen Keene and Melissa Danaher, who are part of the team. And the District Management Council is an organization based in Boston. And we work with school districts all around the country on issues related to strategy, budgeting, implementation, and best practice models for serving students. And the philosophy that we bring when working with districts centers around what we call three circles. And so the first and foremost is we put a priority on what is going to be best for student outcomes. And we use that lens when looking through research and forming views on what best practice is going to really deliver outcomes for students. At the same time, we also keep in mind two other areas that we've seen. And here we can... Oh, do you have a clicker where I can?
Yeah.
Great, thanks. Thanks, I appreciate that.
It's not working for 10 minutes.
Okay, great. So these are the three circles I was referring to. So at the top, we place an emphasis on what's going to be best for student outcomes. And the other two things that we really focus on are, first of all, resource allocation, because we understand that school districts have only finite resources, and I think this has been even more true since 2008 or so, where overall across the country, funding for school districts has remained almost entirely flat. And so what that means is that we're looking not only through the research for ideas on what practices are going to be best for students, but what are the practices... Here we go. That is perfect. Thanks. Not only what's going to be best for students, but also what's manageable within the budget that you already have. We know that if our proposals come back to you and the answer is, well, what you're going to need is this many million dollars more in order to make this happen, that may be a non-starter for you. And so our approach puts resource allocation as a priority as well. And the third, operational efficiency. This has to really do with the complexity of certain practices. What we've seen is you sometimes will observe a district that's done some really spectacular things, but what it requires in terms of what they ask of teachers or the complexity that people have to manage just gets more and more difficult. And so we're looking for the solutions that are in the center of all three of these circles. What's good for students, what is going to be doable within the resources that you already have, and what is manageable to implement so that there's a high likelihood of success that these strategies are going to lead to benefit for students. We understand that Indian River County is a school district that has a lot of strong history, has been recently awarded the A district rating. We understand that you're coming from a place with strong achievement in a lot in for many students. But at the same time, something that we've talked to Dr. Rendell about is understanding that there is a substantial achievement gap between the overall performance of general education students, the line on the top, and ESE students, the line on the bottom. And those bars represent the gap. And so I think in many ways, that's the main reason that we're glad to be a part of working together with you, because we understand that this is something that all of you are interested in improving, and we're eager to be a part of helping determine what is the current practice and what are the current practices in place today. How could you move closer to best practice models that are going to be beneficial for students, and seeing that gap continue to narrow. The way our project is structured, as you heard, is overall a 3-year engagement. And what that allows us to do, because we'll be here for 3 school years, gives us the chance to spend that first time frame really working in depth with you to do this diagnostic phase. And that's part of what we're here doing today. And so you see that on the left under Conduct Diagnostic. And part of that also is making sure that from the beginning, this work is owned by members of the district. And so you see that number one related to establishing goals and assembling the guiding coalition team. That's something that is already being pulled together, and on Wednesday we'll be meeting with the MTSS data review team, who will be the guiding coalition for this work. And what that means is that from the very get-go, we want to make sure that all of this is going to be owned from that MTSS data review team and from the district. Over the course of the next few months, we will be gathering data in a number of different ways to learn about the practices currently in place in the district. Based on that data, based on the observations, focus groups, all of what we're gathering, we'll then be sharing back some preliminary observations backed by research and backed by the data that we collect in terms of what does your current practice look like, what strengths do we see, and what potential opportunities do you have to implement a greater amount of best practice models that are going to be beneficial for students. We'll share those preliminary observations back with the Guiding Coalition team, or the MTSS Data Review team, and then facilitate a process by which that team will decide what do these results or what do these findings mean for us? What does this tell us about what we're doing today, what we might need to do differently in the future, and the change that may need to come as a result? In that next section there, align on key focus areas, this is where that MTSS data review team would go through a process of determining, out of these findings, what do we want to actually do? What are going to be the changes that we need to make? At the same time, we place a high emphasis on communication, because we understand that anytime you're changing services for students, and especially for ESE students, that teachers, administrators, parents, and the student themselves are going to have a lot of questions and a lot of uncertainty about why things are changing. And so we want to make sure that when this group of leaders in the district starts to think through what is going to change, that it's communicated not just in a one-way fashion, but in a way that also gathers input back and hears what concerns or questions may come up as a result of those changes. The next two steps are what we're able to do by working with you together for these 3 school years, is we'll be then putting together a plan or a blueprint for implementation, as you talked about, and then supporting that implementation through potential pilot models if it begins on certain schools or certain grades, as we've helped districts do, and then also determining how you will continue to measure and monitor to see that, A, the changes are really taking place. These didn't just end up being recommendations on paper that never go anywhere, and B, that the changes, once implemented, are leading to measurable benefits. And so that's the work that we'll continue to do with you in next school year 2 and beyond. That's a high-level overview of the project. What I'm going to talk about next is some of the best practice research that we draw on that informs the way that we look at school districts, and in particular ESE. One thing I want to point out is that this is work that we've done with many districts around the country, and districts who have taken these steps, followed through, put in place the types of best practices that I'm about to share, see real results. So on the left, you'll see there are four different examples of school districts, and you can see them sort of characterized. I think that the Newport News mid-sized urban school system is not a perfect analogy for your district, but I think in some ways there are some similar characteristics in terms of poverty level, size not being too far off in the ballpark. And you'll see that the types of outcomes that they've had had a measurable difference for students and also sustained over the years beyond just that initial implementation. One thing I'll also point out on the right when you see that outcomes list is that also part of what this means in districts as they think about what the service model should be for students, what they want to offer, also can mean a reconfiguration of what are the staff that we're going to need given the resources that we have. And so in some cases, we've helped districts make a move towards having a greater level of high expertise staff who are then able to go and make that difference for students. The way that we approach this work is broader than just ESE. We think about this intentionally broad definition of struggling students. And so that includes students with IEPs, in particular mild to moderate disability students who may have some combination of general ed learning experiences and ESE services, non-readers, students who are struggling to read, ELL students, or students who may be at risk for a number of other reasons, even if they don't have an IEP. And what we've seen with districts that approach the work in this way is that for students in all of these different groups, and there are many overlaps between these groups, the types of practices that work well for one are very similar to the types of practices that work well for others. Now, that's not to say they're exactly the same. Certainly what you're doing for ELL students might look different than from students with IEPs, but there's a lot of overlap in terms of what high-quality teaching looks like and how you verify that that instruction is leading to student learning. One thing I do want to point out at the bottom, you'll see the note related to students on the autism spectrum, students with severe disabilities, cognitive disabilities, or newcomers who speak very little English. We are not putting those students necessarily in this intentionally broad group. We realize that the needs of those students are much more specific. We also have practices that we look for in terms of how those students' needs are met. But what we've seen is that the overall approach to struggling students can often come together and meet the needs of many different types of students with the same strong instructional practices. This graphic illustrates some of the key ideas that we have gleaned from research and from seeing districts that do this effectively and how we put them together into a model that serves struggling students. And so I'm going to touch on each of these briefly, sharing a bit of research or best practice recommendation that fits into each. So just quickly, I'll touch on them. Number one, the rigorous general education curriculum serves as the foundation. Two, an emphasis on reading. Three, giving students who struggle extra time to learn. And four, that those interventions must be targeted towards the student need or skill gap. Five, content-strong teachers. What we mean by this is teachers who not only know how to work with students, but also have strong mastery of how to teach their content area. And six, that continuous looping process of using data to track and monitor the progress of students and the success of interventions and the effectiveness of teachers and teaching strategies. The first idea that we put out there had to do with this strong general education curriculum. And this is some data, part of a larger data set, but what you're seeing here on the bottom axis is on a state-by-state basis the average score, the percent of students scoring above basic level, just looking at general education students. And on the left-hand side, you see on the same measure the percentage of students with IEPs scoring at or above basic. And the trend line is clear. What this says is that when you have a strong general education model that helps general education students succeed, that's also likely to be a place where your students with IEPs are succeeding. Because the same tenets that help general education students succeed have a great deal in common with the practices that are needed to meet the needs of students with mild and moderate disabilities. Within that idea of a strong general ed curriculum, we place the greatest emphasis on having strong reading practices. There's a lot of research, not presented here, there's a lot of research that finds that student reading ability is one of the strongest indicators of future likelihood of graduation. So you'll see data that shows that of students in third grade, those who are not reading are 4 times more likely to drop out before graduation. And for students in poverty, the factor is even larger, 13 times as likely to drop out. Reading is of critical importance and must be in place early on, because at the beginning, students will be learning to read, but later on, they need to be able to read to learn. And so these practices here draw on research from the National Reading Panel, the What Works Clearinghouse, and also some of the work that we've done with districts, and summarizes some of the key ideas for a strong reading program into these categories that you see here. And so these are indicators that we look for when working with districts to help ensure that high quality of reading for struggling students. The third point in this model has to do with intervention. And the key idea of intervention that we want to emphasize at this point is the need for intervention to take place during extra time for students. If a student is struggling to learn, the model that we often see says, well, we're going to give students just that same amount of time and they're going to learn what they learn. And the impact of that is if the student has only had the same amount of time but is learning more slowly, they tend to fall farther and farther behind. By the time that student gets to ninth grade, the gap is so large that that's when you start to see behavioral issues. That's when you see teachers very frustrated that they're not able to meet the needs of students. And so that extra time flips the equation and says, instead of giving students a certain amount of time and they'll learn what they learn, we hold the same standard for all students, ESE, students who are struggling, students who are ELL students learning English. And what we'll do is we'll give them the extra time they need. And at the same time, that intervention, and I'm going to skip briefly over this just in the interest of time. This is just an example of scheduling it. At the same time, that intervention needs to be targeted towards the student need and needs to be delivered by a highly skilled teacher. What you're seeing here is illustrative data based on some of the research from the National Council on Teacher Quality. And what this is showing is that even if a student has a solid teacher year after year after year, if the student is starting behind, they will continue to be behind by the time they get to later grade levels. When you're talking about a student who's struggling, whether that student has an IEP or not, one of the most crucial factors is making sure that the teacher working with that student is not just a solid teacher, but an excellent teacher. Because what's going to be required for that student is to catch up year after year. And that means learning more than what the other students are learning, not less. And so it is important that a teacher has that high standard for all their students, and that also the teacher has the necessary expertise and skills to break down exactly what it is that the student knows and doesn't know, where they're succeeding, where they need extra support, and is able to provide alternative methods of teaching so that the student just doesn't have that one chance to get it or else they struggle. But the teacher can continue to drive that student's learning forward. And while without question, poverty and other outside of school factors are huge determiners of, probability factors in determining likelihood of a student graduating, within the school setting, there's clear research showing that the teacher is the strongest factor in determining the success of a student. And so we place a great emphasis on making sure that when students struggle, there's a system in place to make sure that they're receiving high quality instruction from a teacher who has the necessary skills. One of the ways that that often plays out is in the difference between what we're on the left calling generalist support and on the right content-strong support. And I think you've probably seen this play out, whether here or in districts where you've known people who have kids, that sometimes when students struggle, they end up being routed to a room that provides extra time for them, extra support, but it's very generalized and almost like a study hall or a homework help room. And the result of that is a student may have more time to complete their work, but they aren't getting that in-depth support from a teacher with content expertise who can really ensure that the right conceptual underpinnings and the right fluency skills are being built so that the student not only gets by, but catches up. All of this, as I mentioned, is drawn from a wide range of research, and I'm providing citations here. This is obviously far more than we're suggesting anybody goes through and reads right now, but I think what you'll see is we've grouped it by category, and this really represents the fact that what we've done is taken in a great deal of the research that's out there and filtered it through that question of what has strong evidence for student outcomes? What can be done with the resources that a school district already has? It doesn't have to cost more. And what's going to be a manageable complexity that a district can realistically expect that once they decide to take this action, that it's going to lead to beneficial results? And so these are some examples of the research that we found that really meet those criteria and have been of great benefit to districts. So I'm now going to hand it over to my colleague, Kristen Keene, who will take the next 10 minutes or so and talk you through what some of our next steps in the process will look like in the shorter term. Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you, Sam. So I'm about to walk you through what is going to be coming in the next couple weeks to months in terms of the diagnostic phase of our work together. And a lot of the work has been started this week, where we're on site collecting qualitative evidence as one of the key foundations for how we're making our initial observations of current practice in Indian River. So we're meeting with a number of district leaders, a number of focus groups from a wide area of positions and roles to make sure that we hear the perspective from each angle. And also are conducting classroom observations at a variety of levels and also at some of the alternative setting schools. And in those classroom observations, we really, the purpose of those is to take what we are hearing from staff members in the focus groups about what types of service delivery models are being provided to students and what different supports are in place, and then really see in practice what is being done. So during those observations, we're going through very briefly, try not to disturb the classroom setting or the students or teachers, and get a understanding for different settings like the support facilitation models in ESC, any of the self-contained classrooms, and also general education classrooms and any intensive reading support classrooms that might be taking place, particularly at the secondary level. Another big piece of our work is collecting more of the hard data. So in a couple weeks, we'll be asking staff, ESC staff, and any interventionists or support staff to share their typical week schedule with us through an online tool that DMC has created that is essentially a time study. And this time study will help give us very finite, detailed information about how staff are currently using their time, broken down into half-hour or hour increments. So we can really get a deep understanding of, okay, so this ESC teacher is really looks like they're really being pulled and in many different directions and have paperwork, meetings, and other responsibilities that aren't directly working with students, taking up 50% of their work week. So now we have that data. What should we do to potentially improve that practice? So that's the type of information we'll be collecting through the schedule sharing process. And you know, like I said, it'll help us understand the percentage of time that is spent by staff members directly supporting students, what topics are being taught by different staff members, how many students you're teaching at once, are you primarily supporting students one-on-one or in groups of 2 to 3, and in what settings you're supporting the students. And the online tool will be, staff members will receive an email instructions on how to log in and share their schedule. It'll be open for a week. DMC has a phone number and email support line for staff members to contact us to provide any technical or content support. And then DMC collects all that data and analyzes the high-level trends and then pairs that up with what we've been hearing in those focus groups, the high-level themes, and come together and tease out what are some high-leverage opportunities or initial observations that we'll bring back then to the district to get feedback on. And we'll be bringing that information back to the district through the means, a couple different means. First, through that guiding coalition. So the guiding coalition, as Sam mentioned, are really going to be the champions of the work going forward. They're going to take this data that we've helped collect for the district and really tease out, okay, what are we currently doing? What should we maybe ideally be doing to support our students more? And of those different needs that the district has, what should be the priorities and focus areas going forward? Because realistically, it'd be great to, you know, address all 10 items on your list, but a shorter list is better than a longer list, and more areas of greater focus will lead to more success in implementation. We'll also be sharing that information back out to stakeholders. So staff members, administrators who are not part of that guiding coalition, and even parents and community members. And to get a read from them, did we hear exactly what they told us, or is there something missing, and allow them to have a voice and input in this part of the process as well. And this is just a screenshot to show you what that online tool will look like for staff members when they're sharing their schedule. You'll see that the list of primary activities can get quite detailed. And this will be tailored for each different role. So an ESC teacher will see a completely different list from a social worker, from a school psychologist. And those are being informed by the representatives of their roles we're meeting with in focus groups this week so that we have an accurate list of what is representative of their time. And as I mentioned before, with this data, we can get some really finite insights into how staff are using their time. And it can be quite shocking to districts when we share out this information, because oftentimes there's a wide variety of service delivery models being implemented. And maybe it's not to the knowledge of principals or to administrators. So in this example here, it's a report showing the percentage of time spent directly working with students by speech and language pathologists. And this is from a district we've worked with in the past. And you'll see, you know, some teachers or some speech language pathologists are at the top of the scale, and they're spending almost 35 hours per week with students, whereas some at the bottom of the scale are spending barely 2 hours on average with students. So that gives you a clear insight into there are some teachers out there or some staff members out there who are able to make it work with the paperwork, make it work with the meetings, and still spend the maximum amount of their time with students. So who are those teachers? What skills are they implementing, or what strategies are they using? And can we apply that to the role on a whole and help streamline some of those additional tasks that are asked of those staff members and really increase the amount of time they're spending with students. And then this is another example of some of the data we collect. Group size is another important factor that we take a look at. So how many of your staff members are primarily serving students on a one-on-one basis versus in larger groups? Definitely, staff members know how to best serve their students. So I know that Johnny is struggling in articulation, and he really needs to, you know, have that one-on-one support because of his other needs. But sometimes other factors come into play with staff members, like schedules. Often we hear schedules are driving the service delivery model for many districts, particularly at the elementary level. And so looking at how staff members are pulling and grouping students is another key area to look at how can we better support our staff members to increase their time with students. And in terms of next steps, as I said, currently we're doing our focus groups and classroom observations this week, and staff will be asked to participate in scheduling or sharing their schedule beginning of the week of April 11th. And some communication is going to go out to principals a week or so ahead of time to let them know about this process and encourage them to have their staff members complete the time study. And then DMC will be coming back in late May, early June with our initial observations to share out to the Guiding Coalition, to those additional stakeholders in the community, and to the board as well. And with that, I just want to open it up for any questions Sam or I can answer about the process, about our best practices that we bring to the table, or about what's to come.
Yes. You made a very clear distinction between students with mild to moderate disabilities and with higher needs students that are on the spectrum and that are definitely even more expensive to educate, mm-hmm. if you will. When you provide your report, will you be identifying in both of those categories where our strengths and weaknesses are?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And with delineation of practices that may be beneficial for one group versus the other, recognizing that they may not be the same.
Do we have all the ESE students in one class, or are they dispersed throughout all of the different classes?
It depends on what their disability is. There are some self-contained classes, there are some what are called mainstream or inclusion classes. So it all depends on what their disability is. One of the things the DMC will be able to tell us is if we're serving those kids appropriately. In other words, we have them in the right class.
How does a teacher teach to both the ESE student, whatever that exceptionality is, and the exceptionality on the other hand, maybe the top four students? How does a teacher do that and remain sane?
So it depends on the level of the range of student abilities. If there's a student in a classroom that has a severe disability, then there might be a resource allocated to that classroom, an additional teacher assistant or a co-teacher or push in. We have additional teaching staff that's assigned that would work with the general ed classroom teacher to modify assignments, maybe provide additional support, that kind of thing. If the disability, the range is not that severe, then the teacher should be using all kinds of different teaching techniques to reach all the different students in the classroom, whether they have disabilities or not. One of the things that they talked about was high quality classroom instruction, tier one quality instruction. So if we're doing a great job of teaching in the classroom, we should be able to reach all those different levels. If the range isn't that significant. When you have a student with more severe learning disabilities or deficiency, then we're going to have to provide additional support.
Do we place students according to their exceptionality in certain classes? Or do we just, if you sign up for math, this is a class you're going in, ESE or no ESE, they just go where they want to go?
Yeah, so it depends on the IEP, the individual education plan, and the 504 plan. So, there's a team of teachers and the parent that sit down and talk about, what classes would be best for that student and that kind of thing. So they're not just willy-nilly scheduled throughout.
Okay.
Unless they have a very, very mild disability, then they're probably scheduled just like everybody else.
Okay.
And just to build on what Dr. Rendell was saying, two of the strategies DMC has seen work really well in differentiating that instruction to that wide range of students in the gen ed classroom are, one, providing coaching to teachers. So providing that instructional coach or additional support that can help build that teacher's skill set and teach them the strategies of how to differentiate the instruction for those different levels and different skill gaps in their students. And a second approach that we've seen work really well is if you don't go with that coaching model where you're really investing in your gen ed teachers to be the primary source of teaching for those students, that wide range of students, is building in that extra time into the school schedule, that intervention or enrichment period, and then flex grouping your students across a grade level according to their skill gap, and then pairing them with that teacher that's strongest in that reteaching that skill gap. So those are just two examples of strategies we've seen work well and something that we've helped districts with in the past.
I know that I just have a follow-up on that question. Both you just spoke about the additional support, and Dr. Rendell spoke about the additional support. In your experiences working with school districts so far, you know, one of the challenges in this school district, you hear it over and over and over and over and over and over again, when you have these types of challenges, the teachers, we don't have the budget to provide the support that is needed. So that's, like you mentioned, 2008, because of all the budget issues. So that's the reality that all, you know, we face and many school districts face. So I'm just curious, you've been working with many different school districts. What, and I'm sure that a lot of those school districts, you know, my daughter is teaching in Massachusetts right now, and Massachusetts is number one in the state in education. She's doing ESE, and she's like pulling her hair out with all the issues around ESE in Massachusetts that fund students well. When you make, what kind of strategies have you been able to put forth when there is, you can tell us that we need support staff, but if we can't afford it, so what are you recommending?
What you're saying is something that we hear a lot, and it's in some ways actually one of the key reasons that we've found that the work that we do with districts tends to be so well received, is because people have run into this situation where they feel like everybody is telling us, you know, teachers, parents, everyone is saying we just need more staff, more staff. We have done our best to add more staff. We're still not seeing any better results, and now we're at the limit we can't add anymore. And the approaches that we're talking about here, the key difference is, are you adding more staff, or are you providing more time for students who struggle? Because if you add a second teacher to a classroom, if you add more instructional aides to a classroom, you may have more support during those 50 minutes, but the student is still only getting 50 minutes to learn the topic, and you're hoping that that extra classroom teacher or aide is able to make those 50 minutes more beneficial, but at great cost. And the approach that we were talking about here instead flips the equation and says, what the students need is, what a student who's struggling needs is more time and a high-quality teacher, not simply more teachers. And so if you look at an opportunity to say, here we've got an elementary student, a second grader, who's struggling to read, instead of interrupting the reading block that they're already getting from their classroom teacher, who may be offering a very high-quality lesson, instead of interrupting and pulling them out of that, instead, let's make sure that they are able to benefit from that full, let's say, 90 minutes of instruction from their core teacher, and then create a way in the schedule to get them an additional 20 or 30 minutes of targeted time from a high-quality teacher. And this is something that ultimately doesn't have to cost any more, because you still have the same number of students with the same number of teachers. It's a question of how you use the time with those students and ensuring that the right teacher is with the students.
Just as a follow-up, then, so where does that whole piece of professional development come in? Because if you're talking about high-quality teachers, this is all going to hinge on adequate professional development support that's meaningful and targeted so they can deal. So do you work on that aspect of things too, like recommendations?
Yes, absolutely. We're in total agreement with you that if you're putting teacher, if you're putting high quality teaching first and foremost, that means supporting your teachers. We don't provide professional development, but what we do is we work with districts to find ways within the current budget to be able to allocate a greater level of resources to professional development. Kristen mentioned coaching, which is one way that we've often seen that allows for just like differentiated instruction for students, it's a kind of differentiated professional development for teachers where they can get more of the support that they need. And ways of adding that support that are overall budget neutral. And what that sometimes means is dialing back on strategies or investments that the district has made in the past in hopes that adding more and adding more is going to deliver results. And if the district now sees they're no better off than when they were, where they were, but they've added a great deal of additional cost, rethinking how do we use that investment in the way that's going to be best for teachers and best for students. And those are decisions that each district has to make. There are different philosophies about how you want to go about this work, but baked into any findings or recommendations that we provide will be ideas on how it can be done within the resources that you have.
Thank you. Mr. Ross.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions. Mm-hmm. I seem to recall that this may be your first engagement with Florida. Is that fair?
You know, I don't want to give a definitive answer because I honestly don't know. It's my first engagement with Florida, but I will make sure that we let you know.
Okay. No, I think that's a good news.
Okay.
especially since you're benchmarking national. Mm-hmm. And one thing you'll see when you look at the benchmarks is Florida defines satisfactory at level 3 on our assessment, mm-hmm. whereas NAEP defines it as proficient is level 4. Mm-hmm. And there was recently some misleading things in the media that Florida does the best of any state without the Common Core standards, mm-hmm. because our students scored in the level 4, however, that's not satisfactory.
Right.
However, I think satisfactory and proficient should mean the same. However, that's neither here nor there. You'll see that when you dive into that. In general, I believe that it's good that we're using NAEP and other national measures. So, do you have any experience with ACT Aspire or using the Iowa Basic, or I guess it's now September, or whatever, that's following up in other engagements around the country and how that might work in Florida?
Mm-hmm. I see now you may have some more relevant experience in that.
We've worked with districts in the past to refine what types of assessments they're providing to students to make sure that you aren't overloading students or teachers with more assessments, but providing the right assessments that provide you with the data to inform both your investments and both instructional strategies that are being employed in the classroom. So, taking a look at what is different types of assessments are being currently used, and what are the ones we need to get the metrics to measure progress, on the Iowa Basic and other reading proficiency tests like that.
Yeah. And we work with a number of districts in the Midwest, which is a very ACT-oriented region of the country. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Along those lines, I'm sure my colleague will probably bring it up at some point, but you have experience with the achievement gap specific to suburbs?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, that's a priority in a lot of our work.
Thank you.
I just want to say, and you are here as a direct result of this board corporate. The conversation started to and began with transition students that are timed out at 22. That is a very important element of the corporate's thoughts, mm-hmm. and how we can do that better. It then came to the complete full study, and we want a inward look at how we can do better with all students and ESD as well, as well, whether from mild to severe and in between. So you are not starting off with the achievement gap, and knowing that you're going to evaluate the achievement gap of ESE versus non-ESE students. Mm-hmm. And at that point, that's where I wanted to say that I hope that we contract and include the subgroups, which you had mentioned, because that is how we are working towards unity, and we would like to know how that affects some of the subgroups. That's very important to us. Something that I see challenging, and we'll be interested on this is initial on the back end. and it was on your slide 13 with scheduling. What happens with my observation with the moderates is the timing. You give, when you say non-funding but extra time, what happens with extra time, and I try very quickly to look through specials, is that ESC students then, if you're considering specials as in gym and all the specials, then the poor student is working all day with not recreation. So I would be curious and I would be interested to see in the back end how that student gets the full reward. I mean, you know, I remember when we were building Liberty Magnet, there was no playground for 6 months, and then the teachers were like, these kindergartners are killing us, but they had no, and I can empathize, but they had no, the kids had no runoff relief there. So, it's a challenge when you get to older children who do not want to leave classrooms because of the stigma. And a lot of teachers will say, I don't care if it's ESE, 504, we have great teachers who will say, I don't care if it's a non-ESE or 504 student, and they just need extra time on the test, they can turn it in and they can stay after school and they can. So I'm really proud of our teachers who are working outside of those lines, and just because somebody has a label, they don't label. They're excellent teachers in doing that. But it is time management, and I just would like to see on the back end some of your suggestions, because children will miss those, you know, except without staying after school, which isn't, sometimes may not be an option, or I'm not sure. You know, how do you get it all done in a day? Yeah, I'll be interested to hear how that happens at the back end.
Yeah, I mean, that is a big concern, because, I mean, I'm all for academics. You have to keep in mind the whole child, and children need music, they need art, they need movement. I, too, share that concern. I have a question on a totally different level. When I saw the work you were doing on the time studies, how do you statistically account for self-reporting errors when you collect that data?
Yep, a great question. So we do a lot of our analysis based off of what a full contracted work week would be for full-time staff member, and then scale that according to their FTE. So, if they're part-time, scaling that accordingly. And then we have mechanisms in place in our reporting tools that will account for any over-reporting or under-reporting of time. And we also go through and do a data cleaning process to make sure that the schedules that are submitted are only the high-quality schedules, not partially done, so they're not going to be skewing the data.
Yeah, and just to add even a step further, I think we even will take the step of watching schedules as they're being entered in during the week, and if we see someone who's just entering in big swaths of time rather than something fine-grained, we may even reach out to that practitioner to ensure that we're getting data at the level that we need, because it's not going to be good for students, it's not going to be good for you, and it's ultimately not going to be good for us if we're making recommendations based on faulty data.
And then just as a follow-up, in terms of like the complexities of data collection, you know, you also do a group size analysis. And I know, you know, sometimes when I follow a practitioner, for example, that had 4 students that needed one-on-one, so you look at that and go, wow, that's great, that's 1 to 4. But then when you look at the dynamics in the group, through no fault of the practitioner, maybe there's one child that totally does not engage. So they have received technically 45 minutes of service because they were present in the room at the time, but they didn't really receive service because they were not cooperative. Mm-hmm. So how do you account for those challenges when the numbers, because they're just numbers, don't represent sometimes the complexity of the realities of the challenges in these different environments?
You bring up a point that I think illustrates sort of the limitations of that kind of data collection. That, you know, ultimately we can find out and ask teachers, what setting were you in? What topic were you focused on? How many students were you working with? But no matter how much we ask, there's always going to be that next level of detail. But that's why it's so important that we have the opportunity to do focus groups, observations, and really get a flavor in person for how some of these things get implemented. The data ultimately is a way that we can get the broadest possible picture so that we're not just relying on anecdotes or the 10. You know, I used to be a teacher, and it was very frustrating to me if an administrator came in and saw 10 minutes of my class and then acted as if that was the way that I ran every minute of my class. And so we don't want to be in a position of extrapolating too much from a small observation. The data gives us the complete picture, but the observations and focus groups give us more of the flavor of exactly how it looks.
And I think just to piggyback on that, the data that we're collecting is really going to help inform the conversations and decisions that are made after we share out our initial observations. So we take a look at how are students being grouped for speech and language pathologist service delivery models. And then we can have that conversation with district and school leaders. Okay, how should they, what should be the ideal group size according to student need and according to other considerations that should be taken into account on a practitioner by practitioner basis? Like, you know, if two students, their personalities don't go well together, obviously those students have to be seen one to one, and then help work through those criteria settings for what the ideal service delivery model should be. And that's just an important conversation that comes out of this work.
Thank you. I do have a couple methodology questions, if you will. Do the lists for activities already exist, or is that something you'll have to create for the self-report?
We have a template of activity lists by role, and we bring those with us to each focus group we're having with each group of practitioners and have them as representatives of their role make any edits or additions to that activity list. So we make sure that it is representative of your district language, it's representative of what they actually do, and that, you know, it's comprehensive.
Along those lines, it sounds like you alluded to some of the strategies, if you will. But what in the change management plan is there for overcoming things like the added workload of the time study and the not embedded here argument, if you will? So it seems like you've addressed it, but I'd like if you could to provide a little more detail.
Yeah. So the two examples you mentioned, actually, I'll give slightly different answers to each. So the time study, ultimately, we work with district leaders, principals, and make sure also that we talk about it with teachers and focus groups so that they understand the scope and the how much of a burden the time study will or won't be. And ultimately, what we find is for somebody who's relatively technology savvy, it really only takes about an hour in the course of the entire week. And we've, over the years, built and refined the tool to make it the lightest possible load on teachers, and it only needs to happen the one time. So I think, in some ways, the answer there is just we make sure that people understand what's being asked, understand that it's not going to be a recurring thing, and we've also worked to minimize that burden. The bigger picture question about change management, is that, in some ways, actually, that question is, in some ways, what has informed the way that we work with districts today. If you were to go back a couple of years ago, most of our contracts were actually 1 year with districts, and we found over and over again as districts were saying, we would actually really like you to stick around because people are just saying this is the DMC report, and we need this to be, you know, not the from somewhere else, but our thing. And so the way we work with districts now and what we've seen a lot of success with is we also offer this option of 3-year engagement, which means, first of all, that we'll be there to advise, support, and tackle change management issues as they come up. But then the other thing is that we're going to bake in a lot of those change management strategies right from the beginning. So that's the idea of making sure that there's this guiding coalition team who understands from the get-go that it's their job not just to come to meetings, but they're the ones who are ultimately going to need to look at the findings that we share back and make a decision about what's the right move for this district. Because we're not in a position to make any final decisions that resides with the district. And so the data that we're going to provide, I think, will help people have a much more informed conversation about where they want to go. And we'll also be able to share models of how other districts have done this, help people have the right conversations to make sure that plans are well thought through and getting to the right level of specificity. But ultimately, we're going to be looking to your folks to steer in terms of now that we've seen what we've seen, now that we understand how our current practices look, what do we want to do about it?
Stacy.
In your vast travels around the country and all the different states and all, has there ever been a situation where grouping of students with similar exceptionalities across grade levels, has that ever worked? Have you seen that happen? I mean, you don't mix the gifted student with the student who can't read. So, have you had that experience?
So, I think we've seen a wide range. There's districts that have a greater level of what's often called tracking, where you would have students, even potentially from very early ages, grouped by ability level or sort of by perceived ability level according to a teacher, according to an assessment. And then there are other districts that try to go as far towards inclusion as possible, which means we want all students to have as much of the same experience as possible. And often those districts won't really have any tracking at all until maybe you get to high school, where there might be the general level and the honors level. But before that, everybody is together. And there really are pros and cons to each. I think it's a very philosophical and sort of value judgment decision about what how you want to approach that. And so that's not something that we're necessarily going to be weighing in on one way or the other. But I think one thing that we have recognized and is very clear in the research is that when you are looking at an achievement gap between students with special needs and general education students, that one way or the other, you need to make sure that your special education students or ESE students are being held to high academic standards, and that's a really crucial inclusion.
And you went through a couple of different scenarios there. Which one is the most effective at making sure that ESE students are getting the bang for the buck that we get for the money that comes to us? Which way it works the best for those ESE students?
Yeah. So actually the same strategy that we've seen works the best and I think research supports is the best for ESE students is also going to be the best strategy for general education students who may be struggling. And that's that extra time model with targeted interventions. So again, if we look at, let's say, an early grade elementary class, you may have some students who are ESE, who have a disability, and by providing them targeted interventions focusing on the skill gaps that they have by a highly skilled teacher, you can help them be able to keep up and rejoin and get the most benefit from the mainstream lesson as quickly as possible. That exact same approach is also what's going to be beneficial to a student who doesn't necessarily have an IEP, but is still struggling or falling behind in reading.
So the tracking has some benefits.
So I want to be clear, one important way that that approach is different from tracking is that tracking says different students get different core instruction. So this classroom is for the advanced kids, and this classroom is for the on-level kids, and this classroom is for the remedial kids. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about is a model that says all students of different levels are going to be able to be in the same classroom. And the way that that's supported is that students who may be struggling and beginning to fall behind will get an extra intervention that's extra time on top of what the majority of students are getting that helps them catch up and then take part in that mainstream classroom so that you aren't making decisions with a placement in second grade that will have ramifications about a student's placement all the way through high school and beyond.
Just as a follow-up, since you're like getting into the weeds with this, so this is a question that I've had for a long time. So I hear what you're saying about the importance of the rigor, because I think that's one of the reasons why we get the legislation we get, for example, in Florida, because for many years, unfortunately, public schools did not serve ESE students. That, you know, the perception was they can't do it, so we're going to water it down. And in fact, that was detrimental to those students because school districts didn't own it, the state said, you're going to have to do it. And we're all like, but you're not funding it, and so on and so
right.
forth. So that, I mean, I understand that you need that equity, if you will, in terms of content.
Right.
But my question is specific. For example, if you have a student that's at a certain grade, let's say a student that is now in sixth grade,
mm-hmm.
and that student is reading at a third or fourth grade level.
Right.
and you are, they have to take all the tests and everything for sixth grade, but they're reading at such a low level that you know that they're destined. In 1 year, your highly effective, excellent, amazing teacher is not going to close that gap. Mm-hmm. And I was really glad that you made the distinction between the fact that there are other variables such as poverty that impact this, but within what a school can control. We can't control poverty and dysfunction, but we can't control the quality of our teachers. So what does that look like? Because from what you hear about what's going on nationally, especially in your big cities where you have such disparities in achievement, how do you realistically implement this when you've got such deltas for some of your students?
Yeah, you're asking a question that goes right to the heart of the challenge that a lot of districts are facing in America. And, you know, if I told you, oh, well, don't worry, we have an answer that will close a 3-year achievement gap in 1 year, I mean, that would be great, but it's not.
I just want to know what you're doing realistically.
Yeah. And so I think maybe two ways to answer that. So one is, at a certain point, those are going to be decisions that each school district has to make about what do we believe is the right way that we can make sure that we're still giving students who have fallen behind the best opportunities, but also do it in a way that's realistic for what our teachers can handle. Maybe we can ask more of our teachers and we can provide more support, but there's still always going to be that balance. The bigger picture thing, though, and we've seen some districts really get energized by this, is the understanding that the more you're able to get the instruction right the first time and provide that support from early on, the less and less that's going to be the question and the tough decision that you have to face. And I'm not suggesting that that means you have to start at kindergarten and everybody else is going to have to wait 12 years. But it does really remind, I think, it does place foremost the importance of making sure that when students begin to show signs of struggling, that you're there to catch them early. You're there to figure out what it's going to take to keep them on track early, because it's to the benefit of not only the struggling students, but also all students in the district, to make sure that you can have a cohesive classroom, that a teacher feels able to support, and that that's something that's going to exist at all grade levels. But what you're asking is definitely a tough question.
I have one more question. Now, just to be clear, are you going to look at what you're doing and look at all of our guys and how they're teaching, and you're going to come back and you're going to tell us where we are today before you move on with your plan?
Mm-hmm. I don't want and then just a point, they do have another appointment.
Oh, it'll be very quick. In fact, they can leave if they want. because this question, you know, I'm glad we had the conversation earlier about suspending rules and inviting people to speak. I would just like to invite Ms. Cannon to make any comments, if she has any she'd like to make regarding this process or where the teachers are with this.
One of the things that I'm concerned about is I noticed the timeline for the time tool happens to coincide with the testing schedule, which many of our ESE teachers are usually pulled from the classroom in order to administer tests. So you will not get an accurate picture of what the ESE teachers are doing. So is that factored into this?
So actually, we looked at the testing schedule, and that week of April 4th to 11th is one of the lightest of the testing weeks.
April to the end of the year.
Right, but it's actually in between two major testing sessions. So we figured that would be a pretty normal week.
And we also do have the ability to pick up on schedules that look really unusual. If someone just has whole days blocked for testing, that's a sign to us that that may not be a normal schedule.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, can we recess for 5 minutes? We'd love to see that out. Make it known as quickly as possible.
send it to Dr. Randall.
I'm sure you can.
Well, and also I have, you know, I have four different sets of emails, so if I count it, if I put some schedule something, this is the only place that can pop us up.
Crazy.
Give us a little update. The legislature is working right now on the budget for next year, and so I asked him to give us a preliminary look at what the preliminary budget means for us for next year. So, Mr. Morrison, if you could join us up here, and make sure your microphone is on, just kind of give us an update of what's going on in Tallahassee and what it might mean for us for next year.
Dr. Rendell. Good evening, board members. As Dr. Rendell mentioned, he asked me to just kind of take a look at where we are in the budgetary process at the state level. And based on what is coming out of Tallahassee, what does it mean for us for next year, and to identify some of the challenges associated with next year's budget as we see, as we look on the horizon. And before you, what I've done is I've just sort of put a summary and put some challenges and some options of how we can, we feel we would need to address some of those challenges. So in your handout, the Florida Department of Education, through the Commissioner's Office, requested kind of legislative budget request, and that's the first attachment that you have to your handout. They requested a 2.41% increase in total state and local funding, state and local funds, in order to fully fund the budget. What that would have meant for us is an increase of about $3 million. The governor followed behind that, which is the second handout that you have that looks like this, attached to your handout, that I've highlighted in yellow for you. And you will see Indian River. Although the governor requested a 2.57, that's the average of all, we would have been looking at a 2.61% increase, or about $3.2 million increase over the current year. Currently, right now, FEFB funding is expected to show a 1% increase coming out of the conference. At this point, what that would mean is roughly about a $1.2 million increase, or a loss of about $2 million. For those who have been following the happenings in Tallahassee, the legislature decided to buy up some of the required local effort millage, about 0.29 of that mills. However, when they took about $140 million out of the formula, they didn't put all of it back. It was about 86% of the funding coming out of the House. So that resulted in a decrease in of the increase, so to speak. At this time, we haven't received any FEFP runs as yet from the state. And right now, we do not know the split between the state money and the local money. And you're aware that the required local effort is the local millage that is generated through the tax levy that we have the TRIM hearings from. So what that would mean, essentially, and just making it, kind of oversimplifying it a little bit, if the required local effort was 5.29 mils, the legislature has now essentially rolled it back to 5 mils because they've bought that 0.29 mils. So looking down the road, when we go to our TRIM hearings, typically we compare the rollback rate to the current year millage, and if it's more, then we advertise a notice of tax increase. In most likelihood, again, subject to final numbers, we would just advertise a notice of budget here. So state, why is it important to know the split between state funds and local funds? State funds are referred to as categorical funds, and they have strings attached. For example, they fund you for transportation. We have to use that for transportation operations. Reading instruction, we use it for reading coaches. SAI example, we use it for summer school, and you've recently approved the summer school schedule. So those are specific dollars that are used for specific purposes. We cannot use categorical funds to give raises, for example. The local funds give you more flexibility for the board and the superintendent to undertake any initiatives or program expansion, you know, to benefit students. So as a result of that, we're looking at some challenges beyond this year at this point. So again, I mentioned no little or no flexibility for the board and the superintendent initiatives or program expansions. For example, mid-year, superintendent may come to the board and says, hey, I have this wonderful program that I'd like to implement for students. We may, and I'm using the word may cautiously, not be able to fund it out of the increase. Little or no flexibility for the superintendent's leadership council to fulfill school site requests. We have begun our internal budgeting process, and we have sent out the spreadsheets to the schools, and they're returning them to us, and we're compiling them of the requests that they want for their school for the next fiscal year. But however, we do know that there are some things that we have to fund. The first one is that the legislature has raised the FRS rate, the Employer Retirement System rate. The regular class, which most employees tend to fall under, is going up by 0.06%, which doesn't seem like a lot, but you spread that amongst a $100 million budget, and we're still calculating that impact. That handout is on the very last page of your handout, and it shows the various classes: regular class, special risk, etc. Another thing that we know we must fund is teacher performance pay per negotiated contracts. We reserved approximately $620,000 in FY15-16 budget, and we have to fund that per contract. That is a must fund. It's not in jeopardy. We know that we have whatever funding increase we were going to get, we would take that off the top, so that is something that we have agreed to in contract, which we will fund. Dependent upon the split between, as I mentioned, between state and local funding, we may have to use that year two funding and pay for the raises that we've negotiated also with the IRCEA, the $900 per cell. So that will come from your increase. We also know by law that we must fund school site administrators' performance pay per Florida statutes, and that's about $60,000. We also must fund a reserve for recalibration of FTE by the state. And this year, we reserved about $805,000. We did have some students exit the system, and we lost students on top of the recalibration. We'll be bringing that budget amendment to you at the next meeting or so. But we have to make that reserve. We also must fund a reserve for McKay scholarships. The formula, as it's presented, shows gross dollars. And then when you receive your second calculation from the state, they deduct that away from you and use that to pay for the private scholarships. So we have to take that off the top and reserve for that pass-through. We also must fund increases for operations, inflationary costs, utilities, school supplies, things of that nature. The cost of living just goes up by inflationary costs. Some more specific things on the horizon that we're encountering is the federal IDEA budget. As you're well aware, this year we were sanctioned by the state for the disproportionate suspension rates of African American students. As a result of that, we are required to set aside 15% of our IDEA budget, which is about $589,000. those funds are now dedicated to CEIS initiatives and CEIS program needs. So those funds are no longer available to charge your routine IDEA funds, IDEA expenses. As a result of that, and I refer to it as a bleeding over into the general fund because those IDEA funds are now being restricted. The next one, I'll toss the ball to Dr. Rendell regarding the increase in the eligibility of Title I schools because we're seeing poverty being increased in our schools.
So if we stick to our current threshold of 75%, we're going to add two more elementary schools and one middle school to our Title I ranks. You don't earn any more, you don't receive any more money from the federal government. If you have more schools, you get a set amount based on your overall district population. That's free and reduced lunch. So by adding three more schools will be eligible for Title I funding. The amount of Title I funding that current Title I schools receive will be less. It's about the same amount of money that we'll have to divide up now amongst more schools. So some of those positions that are funded by those Title I dollars, those schools are going to retain those positions, literacy coaches and things like that. So we might have to look at the general budget if we want to fund those positions. So, you know, we have more schools that are eligible for Title I funding. If we don't get any more Title I funding, we have to take the funding that we get and spread it out amongst those schools. So the schools that currently receive Title I funding receive less than they do right now, so they're going to probably say, well, you know, these services we found very valuable, we want to continue these services, we need to find a different way to fund them.
Yes. Who sets that 75% threshold? Is that a local decision or a state decision?
We decide that.
What's the negative of having all of our schools Title I?
In the past, one of the negatives would be that you had to face more federal regulations, especially with No Child Left Behind. No Child Left Behind being repealed, with the changes with ESSA, the sanctions aren't as severe as they used to be for No Child Left Behind. So that was one of the reasons why you might not want to qualify for federal funding for all of your schools. There's federal sanctions, how you spend the money, and if you don't show gains in student achievement and you face penalties and that kind of thing. But if it's supposed to be targeted intervention for the schools that need it the most, then you don't want to take those dollars and spread them out amongst all your schools, because then you're not going to be able to use that targeted intervention. Similar to what the DMC folks were talking about earlier.
But that's what you're doing, isn't it? That you're going to spread the money out. Call two more schools Title I, and you're going to spread the same amount of dollars out amongst.
But that's because they qualify for Title I as we have, you know, with the threshold that we have set, because their percent of free-reduced lunch has increased.
And regardless of the money being spent, that also, you also have to account for the, isn't it $1,000 per teacher for extra Title I?
For the differentiated.
So
correct.
Now
correct.
It's a percent. But then the question that the district has to ask itself is, so these schools are also high poverty schools, and so do we just focus on the existing high poverty school and deny additional services to the two elementary school and the middle school that are also high poverty school? I mean, it's a really difficult situation to be in, because it would be unfair not to provide those schools the services they need. But on the other hand, we understand the impact for positions that are currently funded with dollars that are not going to be, you know, and so what is your approach to that going to be?
So we try to provide the same amount of services to all the schools that have similar needs. Mm-hmm. So if the current Title I school, let's say Citrus, says, you know, we're going to receive $60,000 less funding in Title I, so we have this position that we've been paying for out of Title I, or this service that we've been paying for out of Title I that we want to continue. if we take a look at that and find it valuable enough to find funding for that, then that's going to be something that we offer to these other Title I schools that come on board. They, you know, this is something that the other Title I elementary schools are utilizing, and we think we're going to provide level services to everybody that we would try and do that. But you know, we're in the beginning stages of trying to see exactly, you know, what services would be reduced and how we want to address that. But you know, the reason I asked Carter to come and show you all this is because, you know, the budget is hopefully coming out very soon, and we'll have to start to make some decisions. And we're not in any crisis mode or anything like that, but you know, there are some decisions that we'll have to make to prepare the budget for next year.
And I'm sorry, final question on this. So when we are also at some point soon going to have a conversation about the referendum, and if that is a concern for the school district, even though it's, again, limited to a certain amount of time, couldn't we include some dollars in that in order to be able to finance much needed programs? Because that would be in the best interest of children. I think that, you know, technology is great and everything, but, you know, you have to prioritize.
Yep.
So is that something that...
Yeah, we've had some initial discussions about what kind of discretionary knowledge, if we want to pursue one when the 0.6 expires, whether we go out for a discretionary operational knowledge, capital knowledge, 0.6, 0.5, you know, we've had initial discussions about that. Staff will probably make a presentation to you at a future workshop about what we think is best.
And I'm not sure where the staff and charter junior high is at, but I know when I was on their board, it was at 69%. So they were close, but not close enough. And at some point, I mean, we don't want to spread this across to everybody, but at some point,
C3.
Okay, sure. So they went down, which is interesting that they added that other grade. But, you know, I don't want anybody fault because they're late to the table with the statistic. Poverty is poverty. But, again, to provide services, we may need to raise, since we can self-make that bar, we may need to raise that bar to 80. Because 80% free and reduced would be considered poverty. Otherwise, you're going to end up at some point at a tipping point where every school...
But then you're denying the problem. It's like what happened when the Medical Association narrowed the definition of autism in their manual. You can redefine it, but all those kids that have issues are now not getting services that they need and exacerbating the problem, because now you have schools where you don't qualify for those services, you need them, but you fall through the gap. You don't qualify for services, you're gen ed, you're struggling, but you don't get the support. And I hear what you're saying, but I don't know if ignoring, if changing it to me, and I don't know how to say it, it would be like kind of ignoring the reality of the increasing poverty in our community, well, just because we make it higher doesn't make the problem go away.
I
know we're not going to address the problem.
I hear what you're saying, but I disagree. That's not the point of the conversation. The conversation is like from a continuation of the presentation we had before. If a referendum or if this funding is unavailable, you can only do what you can do. So that's going to have to be a way. That is one of the options to address it. I'm just saying, because we could, you know, you can do the opposite and make them all schools of poverty. What I'm just saying, the reality is, if you only have so much, you know, funding, so that's gonna have to come. I mean, and really, we're gonna have to make the decision. We're gonna have to give direction at a referendum. And if we want to not do direction on technology and join with charter schools on Title I issues for funding, I mean, we're gonna have to start opening that conversation.
Do charter schools get funded for Title I through the state or through the local district?
Through the local allocation. You have to rank and serve.
So that's something that is a common denominator. It may not, and yet they may not feel like that. So I'm not sure where their priorities is on that, but that's something that maybe Dr. Dell can
I'll definitely make sure that we prepare some information about the benefits of threshold of the timeline percentages in school, what the impact of moving, of the three additional schools, what that's going to mean as far as real dollars, teachers, Title I schools, that kind of thing. It's just one of the line items that Carter's mentioning is that, you know, that might impact our general operating budget if we're going to have to fund positions that were funded out of Title I from the general operating budget.
And just for curiosity's sake, when your staff does that presentation, can we get an idea of what the thresholds are in other school districts?
Sure.
Just, you know, we're in New River, we're a different flavor, but it'd be interesting to see what the similarities are.
Yeah, we might even be monitoring. We might be guessing. You know, it may be six, we have such a lot of
executive.
So, thank you. So the next item.
One question.
I'm sorry.
Sir, one question. It's hard to see the chairman way down here. She's sitting down in her seat.
It's too dark.
If we're going to take money from one school and move it to another school, and by moving that money from school A to school B, we've got a position funded in A, and now we can't fund that because we cut the money. Why don't we move that person to that other school?
We might do that. You know, we haven't had any discussions with the principals about what services they would not fund with Title I based on, you know, a reduction in Title I dollars, or with the other principals who are going to become Title I schools, what they're going to fund with their Title I money.
Because it's a windfall to the new Title I school. Money they didn't have last year,
right,
they don't have this year, and they have to do something legally with those funds. So why not just move that person that we funded at Citrus to where this other Title
I? That could happen. The argument would be that doesn't mean the need doesn't still exist at Citrus. They didn't suddenly not become a Title I school. They're still a Title I school. They still have the same challenges they had before.
You're just splitting the money more ways.
Just to kind of
ease
up.
Yeah.
It's like we'll have a good. But we'll come back and share all that information
and give us the pros and cons.
Yes, sir.
So the next item on the bulleted list is the health insurance fund. We are continuing to see the expenditures in the health insurance fund exceed the revenues that are coming in. So at the year end, we may have to.
Thank you.
We may have to stabilize the fund. We may have to stabilize the fund from the general operating fund. I believe Dr. Fritz will be coming to the board on March 29th. The Human Resources Department will be doing a presentation because they actively manage that fund. So that will be coming to you.
Can I just ask this one question? So is the district exploring the possibility of no longer being self-funded?
That has to be an option on the table.
Good. It's about time.
And then the last bullet maybe is that we probably may not be able to, again, these numbers are extremely soft, that we may not be able to fund any 2016-17 non-instructional salary increases. So the next set of bullets are just some tools in the toolbox that we can use to offset all of our must-fund items and some of the cost increases that we're looking at. So currently, right now, you have about $1.6 million in discretionary dollars that are out in the schools and in the departmental budgets. It's about $1.6 million. One option that we could look at is doing a holdback. So we would sweep those funds away from the school. Obviously, we would work with the principals to make sure that any plans that they have in place, if they were going to send maybe five people to a conference, maybe they sent three or maybe two. Things of that nature, we would sweep that money back. We would open up the next fiscal year a little early, probably around the April, May-ish time frame, and reappropriate those funds into the new year's budget. The other item that you could be looking at is closing all purchase orders above 90 days. There's a philosophy that says if you ordered something 3 months ago and you haven't gotten it yet, you probably didn't need it, maybe. Okay? So between those two items, you could pick up over $2 million. Another strategy that we've used in the past is to move your one-time, non-recurring items and fund that from your reserves. We've always preached about making sure that you don't use your fund balance for recurring items. That's the equivalent of using your savings account to pay for your utility bill. So, for example, technology purchases, one-time purchases, we could fund from the reserve. It's not recurring. The other thing that we could do is zero-based budget all 2016-17 non-salary budgets to ensure maximum efficiency. What do I mean by that?
Yes.
That.
Sorry.
What do I mean by that? I mean that it's a process whereby the director of maintenance, for example, well, maintenance is a bad example, but I'm using, would walk into a room, and you have no discretionary budget, and you have to justify every single line item on that budget in order for your planning for next year. In the good times, we use a methodology of incremental budgeting. And the disadvantage of this incremental budgeting is, let's say, I came to the superintendent and says, I would like this year, I'm doing a special initiative, and I'm going to buy this microphone. Okay, approved, and it goes in your budget. The next year, that amount still rolls forward in your budget, and we keep adding to it. So the zero-based budgeting goes back to zero, and you start fresh. We've used that in the past, and we have managed our budget accordingly. We also have another option, another tool in the toolbox, which is to exercise under Florida statute what we call a categorical flexibility. State funds, as I've mentioned to you, come with a lot of strengths. So let me give an example. We could use approximately $1.3 million out of the millage, which we will be levied next year, to pay for your textbook adoption. We're starting to go through the process right now of bringing the textbook adoption to the board to go through that statutory process. If you were to pay for your textbooks out of the millage, the state allocation that you receive, okay, it's about roughly $1.3 million. We would obviously, on a pro rata basis, which is required by law in the FEFP, give the charters their allocation. We would put about maybe $100,000 or so out into the schools for replacement of tattered textbooks, and you know we give them money for that. So that would leave about $1 million on the table that you could then flex to meet your operating costs as determined by a resolution that the board could pass. So let me say that again. You have a state allocation which has strings attached to it. You're not denying your students textbooks and instructional materials because you're using the millage proceeds to pay for that. So the state monies that you have now, you can flex that to meet your operating costs as we determine. Another tool in the toolbox has to do with raises. Any raises that we could fund should become a one-time, non-recurring payment, which was not included in the salary base. So let me give you an example. This year, in FY14-15, you've already set your salaries for your principals, your assistant principals, and professional technical to market standards. If we were to come along and give a 2% increase across the board, you're now going to move that salary out of the market range. So what we're saying is we may be looking at a one-time payment, a check for $500, happy health, that kind of thing. So that's not a recurring cost to your budget going forward. So these are just some of the tools in the toolbox that we've used in the past, and we're looking at options for funding to help the impending cost increases that we know we must fund for next year. So all is not lost. We're not ringing the alarms, but I'm just saying that due to the state's action, the expected increase from $3 million has gone down to roughly a little under $1 million. So with that, I'll take any questions that you may have.
Yes, you talked about the effectiveness of zero-based budgeting and mentioned that you've done it in the past. Why did we move away from it if it was so effective?
Each year we kind of do zero-based budgeting light, if you will. We know that we actually keep a list of everything that is approved from one year to the next as part of the Superintendent's Leadership Council meetings and things that are approved. So we look at that list each year, and it's kind of a LIFO method, if you will, last in, first out. So we know that this, going back to the microphones example, we would take that out of the next year's budget. But we don't consistently do that. I must be very honest with you. So going forward, we would look at that as a methodology to control the appropriations.
No, and I appreciate that, because I just think we have to ask these questions and see where we can leverage the dollars.
And I would, that would be the first place I would start, with zero budgeting and justifications, one-shot deals, and determine if it's a want versus a need. Maybe we can live with the microphones we have. But, you know, thank you for your honesty, because that's what happens in government. We don't always do that. That would be the first place, and the last place I'd go to that place. That's just one deal, I'm sure. Because I'm sure you'll find a lot of money. Mr. Pearson?
Yes, Madam Chair. Did you say use the LIFO method?
When I said that, I was looking at Mr. McCain. It's an accounting method, last in, first out.
Have we ever used the fish method?
The fish method.
Deal here?
I'm not quite sure what the fish method is.
See, I was going to help you do it.
The other method is FIFO, first in, first out.
Don't look at the fish deal.
Is that how we report a billion?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I notice we haven't looked at the capital outlay in this, right? One thing that not the carbon board is still pending, but
right, that's why we decided
7029 line 1727. If you look at the strike off, that's up. It goes from 1.5 down to 1 in mills for capital. So I don't know how they did that, and they're still planning on distributing $75 million to traditional and $75 million to public charter.
That's on the PICO side.
But that, oh, right. Sorry. You're right. That's a different bucket. So that's something that, if we're keeping an eye on contingency plans, that's a good one to keep an eye on. And if you don't like to contact Senator Gates.
Okay.
So is that what you're doing? Our legislative liaison, are you contacting Senator Gates?
Mm-hmm.
Your legislative liaison in name only?
Name only.
Okay. All right, now we got that straight. Okay.
And that's
thank
all
you.
I have for you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carter.
Thank you.
So with that, I'd like to resume and ask Mr. Ross if there's anything under his name.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, before we go to committee, I just want to mention something that I was made aware of by our attorney. The Freedom From Religion had a question on the issues and regarding religion in the schools and athletics. And I think I had talked to Dr. Rendell, and I think he was going to check it out. I want to speak for him. He may not have any information back on that, but I did want to share since I am aware. I wanted to make sure the rest of I always want to make sure that was kind of my thought with that section for the attorney to tell us things, but sometimes these things work themselves out, but if they don't, I would hope that our attorney would pipe up and let us know. But since I do know and spend a little time, I want them to share where they're at or Dr. Rendell.
So basically, we were made aware of basically two types of situations, at both of our comprehensive high schools, where basically school personnel might be leading prayers or encouraging students to engage in prayer. And they are not allowed to do that. Prayer must be student-led, student-initiated, and so on. So I've already been in touch with one of the high schools to make sure they understand what the rules and regulations are and what practices we were made aware of and how they need to change. And I'm meeting with the other high school principal tomorrow to talk about the same situation. But basically what we're looking at is it's usually in athletics, and you know, the coach will have the players come together after a game or before a game and to pray. And the coach by law can't encourage the prayer, can't lead the prayer if the students want to come together and have a prayer there, we're welcome to do that. But school personnel cannot be engaged in that.
How did that come to your attention?
Through the communication to our attorney.
The Freedom From Religion Foundation sent a letter alleging certain things, and without knowing exactly what was happening at the schools, I provided the letter and had some photographs attached to it of individuals, and Dr. Rendell has been speaking with the individuals and inquiring at the schools as to what the actual practices are. I hate to take on faith that the letter is accurate. I prefer to have the fact, no pun intended. I prefer to have the fact before we respond with Christian religion foundation. So Dr. Rundell has been speaking with the folks at the schools to find out what actually has been occurring.
And I just want to thank you for bringing that up, because I do think that we as a school district have to recognize the diversity of our students, the authority that the adults have over students. Students can pray, that's their prerogative, but regardless of what our religion is and who the majority religion is in this county, we have to respect that people have other beliefs. We are public schools. We are not parochial schools. So I think it's unfortunate that people have to write us letters to demand that we comply with the statutes. And, I'm glad that you're speaking to the principals and you're reminding our teachers, practice your faith in how you treat your students and how you do your work and how you do your work in the community. Practice your faith, but don't push it on students. That's unacceptable. So thank you for the information, and thank you for taking it on, because, again, it's not about telling people that they can't believe what they want to believe. It's about respecting our children and the diversity, even though one religion may be the majority. It doesn't mean that everybody believes the same thing. So I'm glad that this has been brought to our attention. Thank you, Mrs. Kinchin.
Thank you. And I just want to say, there is a group that, there's some confusion that I'm not really sure if maybe these two of us, but there is, and I want, and I think that's what they're trying to ascertain too, is there is, because I remember during an orientation there was a table, there is a
Christian Athletic,
and where the students can leave, and so that's in the schools too, and that may be what's happening, I'm not sure. So I just didn't want to have the salt group information, just want to make sure that they mentioned it and it's being looked into. We're done going through that. We're on board committee report of any. But Mr. Searcy, did you want to
do that? What about school start now? We're not going to do that?
Sure, I was just going to go to the board committees and then the agenda.
Okay.
Dr. Adelman had wanted bumped up. Any committee? Mr. McCain? Ms. Amenet?
No, I went to the executive roundtable meeting, and I'm just always pleased every time I go to that meeting to hear about the engagement that we have with our community supporting the Kids at Hope. And I continue to pursue the issues around violence and gangs in the community, and there will be a report at some point at one of our future meetings about gang activity, and there will also be reports about services that are available for students, because sometimes we don't, it's not that we don't have the resources, it's that we don't know what's being offered, and sometimes our students are lost if they don't know, if the families and the folks that work with them don't recommend them or refer them to programs that they offer. So that's been an interesting meeting to attend. I love the liaison, but there's always stuff that affects kids and students, and I think it's important to be present to that. Mr. Cross.
Thank you. Really, the only thing of note is the Economic Development Council and the Board of County Commissioners just approved a jobs grant for $177,000. It'll be creating 43 jobs on the Felsmere. Basically, farming ponsa. I mean, it's called duckweed, but it's that's what it is. And then it is. But if you're that crunchy, what they do is they take the duckweed, and they originally was thought to be food for tilapia, and they found that there was a secondary market in humans, and that it contains a very good amino acid profile, and therefore they now dry it out and sell it as lentil. So we do have some horticultural and aquaculture and things like that opportunities, and hopefully there'll be jobs so that students can stay in the county, and that's really all that's happening.
Yeah. I'm on planning and zoning as the liaison, and I continue to go out there. I'm not very specific towards the schools, but I tell you that is an opportunity for growth. They were updating their comp plan, and there is a lot of growth out there, as you know. But also, the planning and zoning last week in Sebastian, this is like great small town news. the old appliance direct, the planning zoning approved, the entertainment center, which will be a laser tag 14-lane bowling alley. And what was exciting to me is that when we first moved down here 12 years ago, Sebastian High School had a bowling team, and they were number one in whatever the bowling district was. I don't know whatever happened to that, but possibilities that Sebastian could have a bowling team again is very exciting. And it is just a very good opportunity for the children of the community. You know, we don't want opportunities for the youth. And so I was just very excited to hear that. That's it for me. Dr. Randelli, you can second that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've asked the Transportation Committee to do, Transportation Department to do a little research. We're exploring changing the school start time of the day for 16-17. There's plenty of research out there that shows that the older students actually do better coming later to school, biological clocks and all these kinds of things, and the younger students actually do better earlier. So what we currently have is high school starting at 7:15 a.m. and finishing at 2:05 p.m. Middle school starts at 8 a.m. and finishes at 2:45, and then the youngest learners, who are most active early, don't start school until 8:55 a.m. and they finish at 3:20 in the afternoon. So what we're having transportation look at, what our proposed start times are for next year, this is just the first blush, it may change. Moving the high school back 30 minutes to start at 7:45 a.m., they would finish at 2:35 p.m. So that's 30 minutes later. It wouldn't necessarily change too much in terms of afternoon activities, after school athletics and that kind of thing. You're going from 2:05 to 2:35 after school employment. Shouldn't change too much. The big change is, rather than just move the middle schools up 30 minutes, is to swap elementary and middle schools and have the elementary start next. Because your younger learners and the research studies show that they're ready to learn earlier in the morning than the older adolescents. So we're having transportation look to see if they can handle an 8:30 a.m. start time, which would be maybe finishing around 3:15. It's really only about 25 minutes earlier for the elementaries, so it's not that much of a big change in the elementary landscape. Parents who need before care probably would still need before care, although we'd be starting school 30 minutes earlier, 25 minutes earlier. And the aftercare wouldn't change too much either, because that time frame doesn't change that much. The middle school is where the biggest change comes. Currently, they start at 8 a.m. They would probably not start till 9 or 9:15, so they wouldn't finish till 3:45 or 4. So the middle school would be the latest start and the latest to finish. Most districts that have changed their school start times around the state of Florida and around the country, the latest start is usually the middle school. In a lot of districts, the elementaries actually start first, then the high schoolers, then the middle schoolers. I'm not too comfortable with having elementary schools start first. You're putting your youngest students out on the road the earliest in the morning, and during certain times of year, it's still dark out at the bus stops. They also would be coming home first, so there would be no older siblings there to supervise or provide babysitting or whatever. So that's what we're going to have transportation look at. We don't actually think there would be a cost, an increasing cost, because we're just shifting the same routes, and we're trying to keep a 45-minute buffer in between each of the sets of routes, which is what we have right now. So we're going to have them take a look at it, do a little bit of a cost analysis, and see if it's going to cost us any more money. If it's not going to cost us any more money, then we'll proceed with going out to the stakeholders and saying, this is something that we're going to do, we're contemplating doing. How do you feel about that? That kind of thing. Most of the communities that have changed their start times in the last 10 years or so have not changed back. Whatever they changed to, they have remained in, and they've seen benefits in attendance at the high school. Our worst attendance by period is, of course, first period, and districts who have moved the high schoolers back have seen an increase in attendance in first period. Sustained over time, yes. Huge difference, maybe not, but a slight difference. Elementary school and middle school attendance rates haven't really changed in those districts, but satisfaction surveys indicate that the elementary schools do like starting early. So that's what we're looking at.
Questions?
Yes,
session this morning.
Yeah, that is wonderful. I recall that we had one of the previous legislative sessions that was a bill that was moving. And at that time, the then superintendent, you know, said that the cost, you know, that it's doable. They had done the cost analysis. I commend you for considering this. Just a question. I know that a lot of districts have been successful with this. I know Orange County was not. I think they changed it to earlier time, and then they moved back. And it would be interesting to learn from their experience. What was it that, you know, I know they're much bigger, maybe the comparison is inappropriate, but, you know, what were the challenges?
Yeah, I'll do some research on Orange County. I can't remember if they actually were thinking about changing and then didn't, or if they actually changed and went back. I think they contemplated changing and did not.
Okay.
But I'll go take a look, do some research on that.
Can
I
have someone from the audience?
I was also going to ask something. If you do the time change, have you talked this over with GYAC and the Boys and Girls Club?
We've had initial discussions with some of the different groups, like Boys and Girls Club. We haven't talked to GYAC yet. We'll talk to Boys and Girls Club and some others.
And obviously, we're in exploration right now. So, yep. In the sense of that, since we have the union president here and she understands what we'll have to convey some thoughts, because I'm sure she's going to go back with what was spoken about. I'm sure you understand what we're trying to accomplish and that nothing's set in stone yet. But any reflections or any things that you see?
Dr. Mandela shared this with me already. We've also been talking about how this would look, because next year we teachers begin an 8-hour day, and so an additional 30 minutes is going on the teacher's day, and that's one of the reasons why this actually started, where that 30 minutes would go. So do we have a tentative as to when the teachers would start with these start times?
Well, for the middle school, obviously, you're going to start earlier in the day, because that 4:15 finish time is probably, you know, about the time the day is going to end. You know, 10, 15 minutes after that, supervision, and that's it. If the high school contract time stayed the same, then there would be more time in the morning. Same thing with the elementary. So really not too much of a shift in the employee start time and finish time, except maybe for middle school.
Because a lot of them are
so. Yep.
So, any other questions? So, we'll keep this posted.
Yep.
I think we've gone through our entire agenda for the day.
I thought we were going to have a chance to go through twice.
Oh,
I don't. Maybe we did, but I did have a question.
Sure.
It's March. Do we have any update on the town halls?
We had some dates set, and then we had to scratch them as we were waiting on some data. So I'll get back to you on that.
Thank you. Anyone else? Last round? Last call? All right, great. So this meeting is adjourned at 3:00.